Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. I was not here last week, so we get an opportunity to cover a couple of weeks' worth of news during the weekly update here at JM and the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
I appreciate that. The what was interesting, and boy, it's devastating, obviously, for everybody around the world when they hear of these types of terror attacks like the one in Bulgaria. What was interesting was how quickly Israeli officials, including the Prime Minister of Israel, was ready to lay the blame for this episode. So let's start with the what he claims is the source of all this, and that's Iran. Was it unusual for leadership in Israel to openly declare who was responsible before anybody took responsibility?
Well, I think that what they were saying is that this clearly bears the markings and the pattern that we've seen of attacks that were being perpetrated by Iran and Iran-backed groups. In this case, Hezbollah and Iran can be used interchangeably. There have been many attacks planned over the last year, year and a half, around the world, and usually they look for places with poor security, let's say, with less likelihood that an operation would be abruptly interrupted or detected or otherwise not be able to be carried out. You know that 6 months ago, 7 months ago in January, they had tried an attack in Bulgaria, almost an identical attack on a bus, and then it was clearly Hezbollah, Iran involved. Now there's more evidence of the Al-Quds forces of the Iran Revolutionary Guard being involved, and they're saying that it's retaliation for the killing of the scientists in Iran, and for the Hezbollah, it's still the killing of Munia, which is an excuse for them for everything that they tend to perpetrate. But if you notice, there were attacks planned in Azerbaijan, in Bangkok, Tbilisi, New Delhi, Washington, D.C., against the Saudi ambassador, Mombasa, and most recently in Cyprus. And all of the MO, all of the information that the officials have been able to put together indicate that it is Iran that is behind it directly and through its various agents. So it could be Hezbollah, it can be Hamas, it can be any of the multiple groups that that they have. And if you remember that the same day was the anniversary, the 18th anniversary of the Amia bombings of the Jewish Community Center
Buenos Aires,
which Iranians did at the time because they were angry at Buenos Aires because they cut off the nuclear cooperation, research cooperation with Iran. And there was Hezbollah was angry because of the capture of Mustafa Durrani in southern Lebanon in May of 1994. So you look at the pattern of these events, why they do it, when they do it. It's clear that this is Iran behind it. It's clear that Iran has got to pay a price for this. This cannot go unchallenged. I think the pressures on Israel not to retaliate, I don't know that it will be as blatant as some people expect. I think it may be much more subtle, but also a significant response to this.
And the retaliation in this case means what? Attacking Hezbollah forces? They're not bombing Iran at this point.
I do not believe that this will be the the turning point on that issue. I do think that there are various options, and as I said, they may be more subtle than an all-out attack.
It could be targeted assassinations. It could be trying to infiltrate certain areas that we wouldn't even be aware of, that type of thing.
And you have a lot of Iranian interests abroad. You could have, they attack embassies. You can attack embassies here. They did not even go after a governmental or military target. They went after innocent tourists, as they did in these other instances, the attempts that failed around the world.
So the Israeli reaction doesn't necessarily mean that they knew of a specific plot in Bulgaria. With the speed and the way that Israel reacted, it seemed like their intelligence services knew that this was imminent, or if they wouldn't prepare properly, it would be imminent.
Well, I think we've discussed this on the air about the imminency of some sort of an action, and just look at the track record. Look at all the attempted attacks that were, thank God, averted or prevented, but the pattern is clear, and the fact that they were going to continue to try to penetrate in some country, in some place, most recently, as we saw in Cyprus, that Bulgaria was a likely prospect because they've done it there before. Did they know that this particular attack on this day would take place? There's no evidence that they did, or else I guess they would have prevented it. But the you know, the tragedy is very great. Five dead, five Israelis dead, two others, and many, many wounded in Israeli hospitals.
Oh, the reports this morning of the funerals in Petah Tikva and Akko and Rishon LeZion were just
awful.
Absolutely awful, with a wife who was also in the attack coming to the funeral in a wheelchair. Another wife is still in critical condition in the hospital while her husband's being buried. And these are all very young people, of course. I mean, the whole thing is just devastating. By the way, I mean, just out of curiosity, I'm sure many wondered about this. We Americans find it interesting where Israelis like to tour and vacation. Is Bulgaria one of those big spots?
Oh, absolutely, and it's because it's very reasonable. They go to this sort of vacation camp where the costs are very low. Bulgaria has nice beaches. When I was in Bulgaria on two occasions, at the airport, you heard more Hebrew than Bulgarian.
Wow!
And and especially because of the tensions with Turkey,
right?
So people turn to Bulgaria as an alternative. They also have casinos. They have other things, but it is known that these particular areas are frequented by many, many thousands of Israelis every year.
All right. With major events going on in the Jewish world, eventually, and I know we talked till we're blue in the face about this, but everyone has to view their institution and their major event as a target, correct?
Absolutely. I don't know what more we can do to get people to sense the urgency of this time, not to panic, and there's no reason to flail around and scream and yell, but there is a very important message, and we try to get it across every week here and in other ways, and I'm still bewildered by the fact that we cannot get people to pay more serious attention to the moment that we're in. People think that nothing can happen, that Iran can't happen, Syria still can explode. There are so many things that can set off and unintended consequences or intended consequences that people have got to wake up.
Yeah. The Olympics are coming up. We know what that means because one of the most tragic terrorist attacks outside of Israel was, of course, at the Munich Olympics 40 years ago.
And look at it. And London has to bring in 13,000 police, army, to supplement the police and everything else because they feel that they did not properly prepare and that they were concerned about the security.
Yeah, there's a lot going on and people have to pay more attention. Malcolm, how could have the Prime Minister of Israel prevented Kadima from leaving the coalition?
Well, ultimately, I don't know if he could have. I don't know whether this was a short-term ploy on the part of Mofaz to regain, as he took control of Kadima, whether they had some sort of an understanding amongst themselves, because the rapidity with which they moved and the unanimity of the vote is really, to me, quite surprising. They may have really lost an opportunity that is unique and may not come back so soon to resolve a very sensitive issue.
Right.
And it appears the difference is between 22 and 26 years old, what age they would no longer be exempt, and I think if that was really the issue, it could have been resolved. It is clear that attempts were made. You had very high-level negotiations going on, Bogi Yaalon for the Prime Minister, Mofaz, and they couldn't reach an agreement. Netanyahu still has a majority, 66. It's not the super majority that he had before, but the way that this all happened, it does not appear to me to be just normal politics.
So you're not ready to lay the blame at either one of them. They both had a role in this split.
Well, I think we have to learn much more about what the issues were, and was this the only issue that, Mofaz has taken a different position on Iran, he's taken other positions. He can't want to go to elections now because they know that Kadima will not do well. Perhaps he thinks that this move will gain him greater credibility within their former constituents. Maybe it is their reading of the politics in Israel. But I hear more and more talk that an election will have to be held before the scheduled one for a year and a half.
Ugh, could you imagine? I'll tell you. I don't know if Israel's ready for that right now. I feel like I always have to apologize when I cite the New York Times, but what an interesting statement. And I said this on the air. What an interesting statement about the state of Israeli leadership, and to an extent we could say, you know, Jewish leadership, because we know what role the Prime Minister of Israel has in terms of Jewish leadership around the world. They basically said Netanyahu is safe for now, essentially because there's nobody else in the Israeli government who shows any type of ability to be a leader in Israel. I don't know if you saw that article, but that was essentially their analysis. There's just nobody else that is showing any leadership qualities in Israel. What does that say about Israeli leadership?
Well, it's not what it says. You know, people say it about America. We say it about the whole world, about the nature of available leadership, etc. But leaders arise to meet the occasion and to fill a void. And what the point here really is that there's no political party, Yachimovich, Labor, Likud, Labor, Kadima, any of them, that right now pose an electoral challenge to Netanyahu, meaning that there's no point to go to elections if you don't think you can win. You might be able to do better. You can position yourself better. Labor may think they will take seats away from Kadima. Kadima may think that they're better going now, Mofaz before. His leadership is challenged. There are always internal political considerations and things that go into a decision about when to move for election, what policies to pursue. But the point is that right now there is no figure on the horizon. People talk about Olmert coming back.
Right.
Because they're talking about a void, and they're saying, who could fill it? Well, maybe Olmert. I don't think Olmert's coming back so soon. He still has the Holy Land Foundation trial, and he had a conviction on one issue, which he is still going to appeal, and we'll have to see the outcome of that. So I don't think that's...
By the way, the Israeli media never reminds us that he was actually convicted on something.
Right, but that was the lesser of the charges.
Right.
But you're right. You know that if it had been Bibi or
right.
somebody, probably the headline would have been Netanyahu found guilty.
Exactly.
Then it would have said on one of the three. Here you said found innocent. What?
Exactly. And by the way, I'm sorry for jumping around here, but you mentioned it. It's outrageous the way that he's tossing out conspiracy theories to the media and they're running with it, meaning Olmert.
Well, people, the police and the prosecutors and others have come under great scrutiny, not just for this case, but in general about the rapidity with which they move, and especially moved with the consequences that their prosecution of Olmert, meaning his resigning and forcing the changes that took place. So some people feel that their moves are excessive, and this becomes the issue in which to show it, and the failure to get a conviction on the two major charges.
Right.
Only underscored it.
Yeah, that's true. All right, before I get to the top of the hour, I just want to ask you, and we'll move on to Syria, Iran, etc. So, and I mentioned this too off the air that I spoke to Yishai Fleischer this week. We were, you know, sort of joking, a little bit tongue in cheek about the Jewish community fighting for kosher hot dogs in Dodger Stadium, and he asserts that Jewish people, especially this time of year, I guess with Tisha B'Av looming, you know, probably have bigger priorities to fight for and worry about. Do you think the moment of silence at the Olympics is a battle worth fighting, or is that a waste of time?
It's not a waste of time. I mean, there is a symbolic significance to say that on the anniversary of the massacre, and that Jewish blood just can't be dismissed, that because they were Israelis and because they were, you know, and Jews for the most part, that there should not be a moment of silence. They didn't ask for a demonstration. They didn't ask for a plaque to be put up. They asked for a moment of silence to commemorate an event that took place at the Olympics.
Right.
Now, is this the most important issue on the agenda right now? No. It has taken on a significance because of the refusal
right.
on part of the IOC. If they had
right.
just simply said yes in the beginning,
right.
this thing would have fizzled away. Now, you have the White House getting involved. You have others getting involved, the Congress demanding that there be a moment of silence. I was in Paris yesterday, and I know there it's become a significant issue.
Right. All right, so I guess those folks who are involved in the efforts should certainly continue, and there are those who are making noble efforts to try to get that done. By the way, back with the Israeli political scene just for a moment then. So today is July 20th. We know the Tal law expires 10 days from now, 11 days, whatever the official, when August 1st officially falls. But practically nothing will happen, correct? Like nobody is in either political danger or physical a situation where things are going to suddenly change, right?
No. It may cause some, you know, internal reactions, but nothing radical will happen.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program. Heard and listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope. Around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Malcolm Homeline with us. We call it the weekly update here at JM and the AM. Information about the weekly update podcast, go to jmnam.org. On the homepage in the news section, you could figure out if you're even the least bit podcast savvy, you'll be able to figure out how to get the podcast delivered to your inbox, to your iTunes on a regular basis. All right, again to the New York Times. In today's paper, no, listen to this, Malcolm. This is, to me, a great way to segue into the whole international scene or the whole Middle East scene, especially keeping in mind what the Prime Minister of Israel or any potential leader, if anybody's ever going to emerge, has to face. No longer preoccupied with the Palestinians, Israel has now been confronted with a series of complex calculations. Should it strike Syria's chemical weapons storehouses, as it did Syria's nuclear reactor in 2007, or would that strengthen Assad's hand by uniting the Arabs? Should it act alone against the Iranian nuclear program it sees as an existential threat, or let the U.S. plow ahead with diplomacy and sanctions? Should it act more aggressively against the military group Hezbollah in Lebanon? How should it navigate the shifting landscape in Egypt, where the new president hails from the Muslim Brotherhood? What a menu of items that the leader of Israel must deal with at this time. It's unbelievable. For those who are a little surprised to hear about all these stockpiles of chemical weapons in Syria, I don't think it ever got the media attention that it got this week recently. What is the situation there? Is there a stockpile of chemical weapons that's ready to fall into the into rogue hands in Syria?
Yes. And it is not that it didn't get attention. I mean, I've spoken about it with you for a long time, and if you mean the general press, yeah, refusal to address this issue and the international community's failure to address it early on. In this case, I can tell you that this has been the focus of attention of the United States, of Jordan, of Israel. They have been working on plans to prevent what happened in Libya, where huge stockpiles of weapons were stolen, sold all over, responsible for the fighting in large part in Mali and in Sinai, Gaza, other places where missiles and other sophisticated weapons ended up.
We always thought the majority of those went to one place, right?
Well, they went to many places. The large part went to Gaza,
right,
and to the Sinai. But they also went to Africa and went to other places. But they also found huge stockpiles, which people were not aware of, the governments, of chemical and biological weapons, mostly chemical weapons there. Syria has the largest stockpiles of these kind of weapons in the world. That's the estimation, that they have it in 50 or 60 different places. Right now, they've been guarded by Syrian officials. The fear is, what happens if those guys defect, or they, you know, seeing the end coming near, will sell it to the highest bidder or any bidder, which means that Hamas, Hezbollah, other groups like that could get their hands on it. And this is something that scares everybody, even Assad, because the possibility they could be used against the Alawites, or on the other hand, there is speculation that Assad has been moving some of the stockpiles, whether to put them in more secure locations or to put them under the protection of Hezbollah, or to move them closer, let's say, to an Israeli front to do some sort of last minute desperate action to either go out with a flare or to rally the people behind him. I don't believe that that's likely. Israel certainly on constant alert. When I was in Jordan, spoke to people there, this was a big issue for them, and they are definitely looking at this issue. But these are very dangerous weapons, that the possibility in a collapse that you could lose control, and therefore I think the United States, Jordan, others, Israel, are watching this constantly. This
The question should strike
concern, and it has been for a long time.
The question should it strike serious chemical weapons storehouses the way you just described it? It would be impossible to do that.
Well, the danger with that is first that you release the weapons into the air, and because you're talking about a very close proximity, it's these things can be blown in any direction. So it's
but just the way they're stored,
it's not an easy thing to do. I know people's reaction always is, so why don't they just bomb them?
Right. But just the way you described it geographically, they're in too many places.
That's true, and that part of the idea behind this move may be to consolidate them in a lesser number of locations, so that you could have troops available. You know, there is a movement of troops in Syria right now. For instance, they've been moving troops away from the Golan, Syrian troops away from the Golan to Damascus, which, as you know, I've always said is the key test, that once Damascus goes, Assad is going. That they are obviously having manpower problems, and the one place you can't afford to have that is where these chemical and biological. Just think what Hezbollah would do to get their hands on these kinds of weapons.
So what would you like the U.S. to do when it comes to Syria?
Well, the first thing is that we've got to send really tough messages, and that day is perhaps past when we in the West should have taken a much stronger stance. I think right now there are a variety of steps that we can take to prepare for any eventuality, meaning creating the circumstances that would enable a transition to a government that won't be just dominated by Muslim Brotherhood, as happened in other places, because they weren't prepared, or that tries to bring together the alternative groups, and there are many, unfortunately, and they're disunited, and amongst them are guys who are not good guys either, but that we should have taken more of an assertive role in trying to shape an alternative to provide for an orderly transition, which would also get us the support of the Russians, who fear an Islamist regime or others taking over the government, and say that if there is an orderly transition away from Assad, that they would be prepared to back us. You know, they vetoed the resolution.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I would think they'd go with the sanctions if that was their concern. Is it, in fact, the opposite that would be better for them?
Well, Russia has, and we've discussed this over the years, a variety of agendas. One is sticking it to the West. Two is they so heavily invested with him, you know, that many of the demonstrations are against Russia. Russia will be a big loser with the fall of Assad.
No matter who takes over.
Right. And because of the hatred amongst the people, and so they are looking at what the major interests that drive them. One is not to allow another Islamist regime. Two is not to have regime change, because their fear is about it spreading to Chechnya and to impacting them more directly. They also have a naval base, which is not of such military significance as it is symbolic significance. There are a whole litany of issues which, aside from the arms sales, etc., that motivate the Russian thing. But what the Russians have been saying, and Putin said this when he was in Israel in his discussions and elsewhere, we have to look at what is at the internal situation, and the fact that you have no one group emerging, but you have the Syrian Free Army actually taking more control today. They took over the crossings from Iraq, which is very important, because Al-Qaeda of Iraq has been crossing in. You have today at least 10 different foreign and Syrian groups with different ideologies who are waging this jihad and who are involved. You have guys coming from Kuwait this week. We've had them from all the other countries, from Saudi Arabia, from other countries, and certainly you have Al-Qaeda elements there coming from Iraq and from elsewhere, in addition to having on the other side, you have Iran with estimates up to 10 or 15,000 troops, or Hezbollah having thousands of people in the country active. You have huge numbers of defections now going into the many thousands. You have perhaps almost a million refugees of one kind or another dislocation in the country, and hundreds of thousands who have gone to Jordan, Turkey, and elsewhere. And what the United States' goal is to get a managed transition to try and pull together the forces. Unfortunately, the opposition is very divided against each other. You don't have any leader emerging who could pull everybody together. And I've talked to some of the opposition leaders, and you know, they have very different ideas, and everybody has a different motivation. Some have religious, can be political, can be a national entity that's behind them. He looks like he wants to create an Alawite state. If you look at the way the cleansing operations and some of the military operations of the last days, you see that he is trying to carve out an area that might be defensible as an Alawite state and give them the ability, after he's out, to still sustain themselves. As I told you many times, I think when I met with him, this was something he said before a single bullet had been fired, before anything had taken place. He said, "I will never step down because they will wipe out the Alawites." And they will. If given the opportunity, there will be massive retaliation, and people are arming themselves. There are, and you see he's moved away from trying to crush the Sunnis more towards this kind of effort to create an Alawite entity within that might be defensible. Well, I don't even know if that's possible.
Why did it take till now to start this effort? I would think that in the previous regime they would have made this effort to secede.
Well, there were efforts. It's not to secede them. Remember, the Alawites took over control, and many of them became very wealthy. They are 10% of the population of Syria, but hold all the key positions because Assad's only trusted them, being of the same tribal structure, as well as some of the other minorities who were fighting with them for fear of what would happen if they fall. So this is not really new, the issue, and they have specific areas in the mountains and elsewhere where you have concentrations of Alawite populations. The problem is that they would not be defensible in and of themselves, so I think what the move that I'm describing may be just an outgrowth of the fact that Assad is finally come to terms with the fact that this could be the end of his reign, or the beginning of the end, at the very least. You see Damascus, the fighting.
Yeah.
That is a huge psychological shift, aside from the physical, the fighting near the presidential palace. The fact that you have it in Damascus, that in business sectors, other sectors that were loyal to him, people are turning against him. The bombing this week in Damascus, huge psychological implications, aside from the political and the physical. And it was a huge bomb, and it was days in the planning, and it was carried out, you know, that the small bomb was in chocolates and the big bomb was in a flower pot. It wasn't a guy just walked in strapped with these weapons.
Right.
So this was very significant. And because you have all these foreign elements who don't care about what happens to the country, or coming in there to fight for ideological and other reasons and to create, and are looking for what role or what they can carve out in the fact of the collapse of the government.
Were you disturbed by the content of the meeting between the new leader in Egypt and Hillary Clinton?
I'm certainly disturbed by the fact that we're not appearing not to be holding Morsi more to account for what he says. And there are a lot of misreports, you know, the idea that he got invited to Washington. He was not invited to Washington. He was invited to meet the president on the sidelines of the UN meetings that are taking place in September. I think the secretary was right to go there. But the message to the rest of the Middle East, and as I said, I was in Europe meeting with people and others during this past week, and the idea that we're not taking seriously the Muslim Brotherhood part of Morsi's victory. And when he talks about creating a caliphate, this is something you got to take seriously. This means a lot. It's not dismissive language. And when the United States and others play this down, we do it at our own peril. We never seem to learn the lesson of this. And with the tremendous changes that are taking place, you know, the United States is building a new missile defense radar station in Qatar to supplement the one in Israel and Turkey to monitor what's going on in our world, the missile shipments and the potential dangers, and of course from Iran. But you have a situation of such complexity right now, and so much that we could talk about, and we could spend hours and not cover all of the threats and things that are going on, that if we don't send a clear message of what we expect, of what we're going to hold Morsi to account for what he says and for what he does. And the expectations, she certainly said that the, what they expect in terms of maintaining the peace agreement with Israel, and raised the situation in the Sinai. But there has to be clear markers and clear messages to others that, you know, the Sinai, there were at least 12 attempted attacks against Israel that were reported. The situation there, which, you know, we warned about for, what, the last year, we have to come to terms with it and begin to understand. And we when we send wrong messages, whether it's about Iran or about Morsi or about Erdogan, you know, if people in the Middle East don't take seriously when American leaders say that all options are on the table, and if they don't believe that that will really be carried out, and the secretary said that Israel and the United States are on the same page on Iran, the question is what the bottom line of that page is. And there were certain options that I don't think that they yet are in complete agreement.
Well, did anything disturb you about the content of her meetings in Israel?
Well, we haven't got full information yet on the meetings. It is true that the U.S. and Israel are in close consultation on Iran.
Was she, in fact, outspoken about the Pollard situation?
I think she was asked. I don't think it was something that she initiated, but she did say that she didn't think he would be released. And I think it's unfortunate. I think she could have avoided answering the question,
right.
If she didn't want to.
She could have said, we'll take a closer look at it or whatever.
It's a closer look. It's not right. State Department decision, whatever.
Right.
It was disheartening to a lot of people, but I don't think it's not something she intended to say. Was not something she initiated. It was in response to a question, so we have to find out whether that was just an offhanded response to say, look, nothing's imminent,
right?
Or was she really staying a policy?
So what do you think of this menu of items that the leadership in Israel has to face at this point?
That's why I would never want to be prime minister of Israel.
Exactly.
It's if you look at the whole range of issues where Iran, everybody today, I hope, understands. They still don't get the urgency of it. We see the Iran Revolutionary Guard expanding the nuclear facilities and nuclear production, that all the talks haven't stopped one centrifuge, and even the Secretary Clinton said that the talks so far are non-starters and that the P5 won negotiations. If you remember, the administration came in saying that they wanted engagement, that they were the ones pushing the negotiations track, and many people, especially in Europe, warned that this is a non-starter, and Israel said it all along, that they take advantage of negotiations. Not that we shouldn't be talking, but that the talks have to be based on a clear understanding on the part of the Iranians about what we would do. And you have to give the credit for the sanctions that have been put in place. They do hurt, but they're not enough. It's not what's going to bring down this regime. And they find ways always to get around it. You see with China now, how the exemptions given to China, and all of a sudden they're building and they're trading. There's a report that came out this week about Germany still providing dual-use technology and some technologies that are directly applicable to a nuclear program and helping it to become, with equipment and stuff that will be more defensible on their part, harder to hit from the other side. And the development in Iran of new units of the IRGC, Iran Revolutionary Guard, specifically designated to bring scientists and others together to develop the detonators in secret locations beyond the ones that we know about. The Prophet 7, I don't remember if we discussed it.
Yeah, it doesn't sound familiar.
When we were away, about the missile. Now they've taken the missile exercise, but they showed their capability of carrying the war way beyond their borders.
Right.
So if you're a leader of Israel, you have to look at it. And people say, so why don't they just do this? Why don't they just bomb? Because there are so many considerations that you have to take into account. You have to think not just about the action, but what the reaction will be. You have to think about what the next stage. Israel is focusing on the Sinai, for instance. They moved Iron Dome to Eilat because of the changes in the Sinai, and as the border fence is completed, will help the situation, but it's not going to stop the ability to fire missiles. The Hamas fired missiles from Gaza into Sinai, showing that they've mastered technology also, and did reverse technology on missiles they got from Libya to create their own. So each of these things escalates the danger in the region, not just to Israel, Jordan, to the Gulf, to Saudi Arabia, to everybody.
Unbelievable. A record number of people came out to Rabbi Al-Yashiv's funeral. He passed away this week. You had encounters with him during his lifetime, right?
I did. And if people knew his humility, aside from, you know, obviously being in the Posek Hadar and many other things as a religious leader, but his humility, he lived so humbly when he could have had anything he wanted, and he didn't. You know, he never published a sefer. He was a man who was so devoted to learning in any instance and all the time. I mean, he always had the sefer open in front of him, and until the end, that was the case. And he lived a very full life, and he impacted many, many people. So it is a great loss for Klal Yisrael.
Next week, we will be speaking on Erev Shabbos Chazon. Essentially, it's Erev Tisha B'Av because Shabbos is the ninth of Av. So Malcolm will turn to you for an important message, no doubt, at that time. Thanks.
And after that, all the news will be good.
You think so?
After Tisha B'Av?
Maybe even before Tisha B'Av, you know.
Could be.
You never know.
Tisha B'Av, the following Friday, then we know for sure it's going to be great.
Why? Because we're not going to be speaking that Friday?
No. But Tisha B'Av.
I know. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Next week we will speak on Erev Tisha B'Av, and the following week we'll be live from Champions Gate. So we'll take a week off the weekly update and then back to a regular schedule, Bezrat Hashem, for the remainder of August. And we do hope, in fact, that the news continues. Yeah, let's look at it that way, that it continues to improve. There's always some good news out there. So let's say we hope to be able to talk about even more good and wonderful news.